If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
In fact, I made lists of them. Some crimes over that winter were called a Jack Shepherd crime because the press had called them that. Some were called a Jack Shepherd crime because, say, the magistrates or the judges had called them that. And some were called a Jack Shepherd crime because the perpetrators had called them that.
That was Claire Harmon on the impact of literary descriptions of crime in the 19th century.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History magazine. Today's interview is with the author and biographer Claire Harmon, whose latest book delves into the murky world of Victorian murder. She spoke to our staff writer, Ellie Cawthorne.
So today I'm in Oxford to speak to the award-winning writer and biographer Claire Harmon. Claire's latest book is Murder by the Book, a sensational chapter in Victorian crime, which looks at how the murder of an aristocrat in 1840 sparked a moral panic about the nation's reading habits. Claire, can you tell us a bit about the murder of Lord Russell and why it's so interesting to a literary biographer like you?
Well, I kept coming across references to it in the papers of writers, because I was writing a book about Charlotte Bronte and I was researching things that connected with Thackeray and Dickens. And so, first of all, it came to my attention as a ghastly, notorious murder of 1840. And I didn't know of any connection between it and the literary characters at that point. But because, you know, if you're doing any research into a particular time, you get to investigate all sorts of byways and you're willing to be and are readily diverted during your research into topic A. And so I kept just picking up on the importance of the murder, not because the victim was anybody particularly well known, but the family, of course, was very well connected. And the Russell clan were a very, very significant Whig family and, you know, had fingers in every political pie at the time. But Lord William himself was, you know, this rather sad, lonely old gent living in Mayfair. And so it didn't really seem to me a very notable murder until I found the connection between his murder and a literary controversy of the time, which then partly explained why all the writers were so animated about this crime, but also that it really did extend for them a controversy that had been going on for about 18 months before the murder took place, and that had really gripped literary London. They'd got themselves into a real stew about the literary controversy, and then the murder seemed to just extend that and make it more appalling than they could possibly have dreamt. What happened on that night, the 5th and 6th of May in 1840, was quite puzzling to people because in the morning, the servants discovered their master's body in bed. You know, so this was actually in a bedroom in Mayfair, and his throat had been cut really deeply. I mean, so his head was almost severed. It was one huge gash to the throat. And there were signs of a burglary. There were things scattered around the house. It looked as if somebody might have broken in through the back door and then gone out through the front door, which was not open, but it was unlocked. And there were little bundles of things around the place. You know, the furniture had been overturned. So the immediate assumption when this was all discovered in the morning was that there'd been a bungled burglary and that Lord William had been murdered because he was there in his room. But of course, it didn't take very long to think that there were some puzzles about that. You know, why weren't more small items taken away? I mean, why were there bits of silver still wrapped up by the door? Why would anybody actually need to murder somebody in their bed if he was asleep? What on earth was this all about? And why hadn't more been stolen, really, too? It seemed like a peculiar set of circumstances. It shocked people, obviously. I mean, it was shocking that anybody could break into a house and murder someone, especially when the new police force was assiduously patrolling that area. In the notes, the police force notes, it says that they came around every 12 to 13 minutes, which is an incredibly small beat, isn't it, if you think about it? I mean, those two constables must have been circling round and round all night, although those two people did also say they were drawn away at between 2 and 4 in the morning to another burglary. Somebody criticising the police in the wake of this murder did say, the streets are all very well now, they're safe, but it's driven burglars indoors, you know, so they're actually breaking into houses to get out of the sight of the police, which was a rather strange theory. But, I mean, it was part of this concern about, you know, what was going on, how could you be safe in your house anymore? So it does become a story which has a lot of narrative going on. It's got a lot of elements of a story that then can't be accounted for. And that did partly intrigue the writers who were watching this story unfold. But then, of course, when there was the further information that the crime could have been connected with an actual book, that also implicated them as well as just intriguing them.
Perhaps you could elaborate a bit on the connection between the crime itself and the expansion of cheap reading materials that people were really worried about.
Yes, well, the crime itself happened on the 5th of May, the night of the 5th and 6th of May, 1840. The prime suspect was identified pretty quickly, although those first few days were also full of suspicions of other people. But there was an arrest fairly soon afterwards. There was a trial in June and there was an execution in early July. So between, you know, it was only 2 months during which the whole of this drama was being played out. But during part of that, when the suspect was in prison, awaiting execution, that's when the news broke that he confessed to having read a book that had inspired him. Nobody had been able really to work out why on earth he killed his master, if indeed he was the only person involved in this crime. But he hadn't really made any statements at all, and the motive seemed a bit feeble and peculiar. But then when he came up with this either excuse or real reason, and who is to know, of having been profoundly influenced by a novel called Jack Shepherd. What had happened there was that the year before, in 1839, when Jack Shepherd by William Harrison Ainsworth started to be published. It was a very popular piece of kind of pulp fiction, really, in certain ways. Although Ainsworth was no slouch, and he prided himself on doing historical research, which, you know, he did some tremendous research really into all his subjects, but then he'd kind of jazz it up and make it into a kind of rip-snorting novel. And he was especially successful with Jack Shepherd because it was a story of a kind of lovable thief, you know, somebody whose crimes were actually not terribly appalling, mostly just housebreaking. But who kept getting caught by the authorities and who kept escaping from prison in more and more bizarre ways. And it was based on a real life character, Jack Shepherd from the 1740s, who was very well known to, you know, to everybody, really. He'd been in the popular culture for about a century. He was the character from whom we get the phrase Jack the Lad, that kind of snook-cocking, cheeky, young, underclass criminal hero was a subject ripe for Ainsworth's pen. And Ainsworth really hammed it up. And it's a very alluring novel. It's not beautifully written, unlike the novels of Ainsworth's friend and protege, Charles Dickens. But Ainsworth's book really hit a sort of note with this public that was a new public, basically. Between the 1820s and the late 1830s, printing became much cheaper. If you were working class person, you could buy a book. You didn't often bother buying a book because you could also borrow a book from the circulating libraries, which bought, you know, all the major sort of popular titles in droves. And of course, it was exactly the same point at which literacy was really taking hold amongst working class men and women. And nobody was rewriting for this audience. If you think of what the novel was, a fairly recent phenomenon anyway, if you think of the novels of Richardson, Fanny Burney, Jane Austen, and, you know, Maria Edgeworth, all these kind of novelists of the turn of the century, they weren't writing books which your average manservant or maidservant in London would particularly appreciate. Once printing became cheaper, of course, there were titles written specially for that market. There were formats devised specially for that market, you know, like broadsheets, pamphlets, knockoff versions of more famous works. And real money could be made there.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
So what was it about Jack Shepherd that really got people's backs up? Was it the fact that it was a lot more violent than anything that had gone before, or was it purely because it was reaching a much broader and, to some minds, worrying set of people that might be reading it and getting the wrong idea?
I think the latter is the case, because certainly it has got some very violent scenes in it, but it's no more violent than a lot of, you know, low-grade fiction. In fact, it's quite restrained in some ways. So, you know, I was reading it for these passages that might inspire me to crime when I read it myself. And I can't say I was moved to do anything at all naughty even. So it's slightly puzzling about how it could have been seen as a huge moral, you know, a danger, unless you see it in terms of that reach that it had. And it also wasn't so much a matter of people reading the book. So a lot of the ways in which people would have experienced Jack Shepherd in that year, 1839 to 40, would not have been Ainsworth's actual novel, but it would have been the theatre versions or the little sort of chapbook versions of the theatre versions, or the songs from the chapbooks of the theatre versions derived from the novel. And so, you know, as with all these things, once a text gets diluted and gets out into these different forms, it reaches a huge audience. I mean, it goes, as we would now say, viral, but it also accumulates other meanings, and it gets coarser in some ways. It also gets more specific. So I think the Jack Shepherd story became one of anti-authoritarian, you know, it was a class war story in the end. Nobody really cared about Jack's burglaries. Nobody particularly worried about the murders, because all the criminals in the story are seen to be actually the geezers, you know, the diamond geezers. So it's a bit like The Craze or something. It's, you know, did completely glamorized that world rather than the crimes itself, but the whole culture, the underclass culture.
You mentioned their class and the role that played in all of this. What do you think the murder and the reaction to Jack Shepherd tells us about class divisions in England at this time?
Well, there were many of them, obviously, and there was also this. It was exactly the period of the greatest fears about Chartism and the masses rising up. I mean, you had these, you know, mass rallies like the ones outside Manchester, you know, tens of thousands of working men. It was usually almost always men would gather, and they were really asking for universal suffrage. I mean, after the Reform Bill of 1832, you know, which enfranchised a lot more men than before, but there was still a property qualification. And it obviously assuaged a great many people's feelings, but not enough. And it quite clearly provoked a hunger for more reform and highlighted the kind of the bad old days of the Whigs, which actually the Russell family completely represented, as well as being liberals and reformers. They were old-style aristocrats who basically voted in their own obsolescence with the Reform Act. It did seem that once, you know, that the lid had been taken off some kind of box, there was a great deal of agitation, I think, between ordinary working people and their supposed superiors. Something I found very interesting when looking at the actual structure of individual houses in Mayfair, and also houses relating to each other within Mayfair, Mayfair being, as it is now, one of the most exclusive residential square miles in the country. Of course, you have all these rich aristocratic and you know, army types and lawyers and dukes and dowagers living there. But of course, they have servants living in layers. So, I mean, the class structure of Mayfair can had a horizontal and a vertical aspect to it. You know, so you'd have the class of people who owned the houses or renting them. And then you have this massive, far greater number of servants. The people across the road from Lord William had 11 servants in a household with two adults and two children in it. You know, I mean, that's a lot of, as it were, strangers to be living with, isn't it? And it did provoke a lot of anxiety amongst householders, you know, how to run your house in this age when your manservant might be a reader, you know, your maidservant also might be literate.
It seems to me at the heart of this, and something I found really interesting in the book, is somewhat of a hypocrisy, which is that Jack Shepherd was censored and there was a great deal of disgust at it. But at the same time, there was a huge amount of publicity about how it inspired this murder, how terrible it was.
Mm. Well, that's a moral panic for you, isn't it, really? It lands on something and we only really get to read about it or perceive it historically if it then is corroborated by some actions. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent, because once you've got this term, A Jack Shepherd, in the press, which it was all through that winter, I was very struck by how, in fact, I made lists of them. Some crimes over that winter were called a Jack Shepherd crime because the press had called them that. Some were called a Jack Shepherd crime because, say, the magistrates or the judges had called them that. And some were called a Jack Shepherd crime because the perpetrators had called them that. So, you know, there were various ways in which crimes, usually petty theft in that winter, would be described as a Jack Shepherd. I mean, as if there hadn't been a winter before when young men had broken into houses to steal things. I mean, obviously, this was a form of crime that was just, it will never have a beginning or an end. But at that point, it was associated with the book because the book was thought to have stirred up a sort of extra audacity about that type of crime. And also, I think what really stuck in the craw, certainly of a lot of magistrates, was the lack of remorse shown by some of these young criminals. You know, that they didn't actually care. And some of them sought to be associated with it. They just wanted to be copycat criminals in the mold of Jack Shepherd because it was the big cultural deal. You know, so it had that sort of draw of anything that we have in the movies now that would be, you know, particularly alluring, or, you know, a phenomenon like sort of Harry Potter or, you know, Star Wars or something like that. People who wanted to be associated with it in its smaller way, much smaller way, it was as powerful in 1840.
This is the very, very beginning of the Victorian age. And I think a lot of people in the popular imagination, when they think of the Victorian age, they think of murder and crime in dark, misty alleyways. That may well be because of things like Jack the Ripper. But do you think that the Victorians did have a particularly grisly appetite for murder that perhaps has carried through to our modern day? Or is that just a modern misconception?
I think it's a lot to do with a modern bracketing together of all sorts of things under the word Victorian. And as you point out very correctly, I mean, 1840, Victoria had only just come to the throne, and nobody had a strong sense of Victorianness, as they also didn't have a strong sense of Dickensishness. But Dickensian and Victorian are now these powerful adjectives and that encompass all sorts. I mean, poor old Dickens. I mean, Dickensian London is a London of dark streets, poverty, you know, intrigue, passions. Because he wrote novels of his time, which he couldn't exactly help. But there were some, you know, grisly murders, no more or fewer than at any other period, I would say. But perhaps we just like the costumes and the sort of production values. And it does suit our sense of, you know, crimes being committed in the dark. And I suppose the Victorian era is the last dark, literally dark age, because if you think of they had gas lamps and they had gas lighting, but you know, once you get electrical lighting as a norm in the 20th century, crimes actually do seem different. It's a rather indulgent myth, isn't it? I mean, we like to sit and also like ghost stories, we associate those with Victorianness.
A lot of the way we think about the Victorian age is to do with literature, and as a literary biographer, I'm sure you've written quite a lot about that. Could you tell us about you've mentioned Dickens, but some of the other literary giants who were kind of involved in this or influenced by this event?
Yes, well, Dickens is involved in it and sort of slightly implicated in it too, because of his authorship of what was seen as a Newgate novel. It was early in his career, Oliver Twist, which we now think of as a Dickens novel, but at the time people totally associated it with this school of criminal romance, books that were written for a rather vulgar and crude audience. The other big name who's involved in this case was William Makepeace Thackeray, who again, he did write a novel in the 1830s, but he only wrote it as a kind of satirical exercise, and it was a very strange novel. He was trying to write his own Newgate novel in order to sate the public with something absolutely horrific. So he wrote a truly unpleasant novel. I mean, Jack Sheppard was vilified as being violent, but Thackeray's novel is disgusting, and he intended it to be disgusting. He chose a really gruesome crime from the Newgate Calendar, and he wrote it up with no holds barred, and nobody took much notice of it at all, and it didn't work. I mean, it was a bad idea, not terribly well executed. But there was, you know, Thackeray, who went on to write Vanity Fair, but this was his first go at writing a novel, because he was a journalist, really, and an illustrator at the time. But he was very, as you can tell by the fact he bothered to expend his talent on this worthless project, Catherine, he was a very, he was profoundly upset by the Newgate phenomenon, and he wanted it to be hit on the head in some way. I mean, he wrote against all the Newgate novelists in the periodical press, and he kept adopting aliases so he could get more criticism of them in. But he just didn't realise how feeble that kind of campaign would be against this mass market appeal that the books had, and that if he was going to counteract that appeal, he would have to do it in a mass market way and not in this kind of little clubman's infighting between the periodicals way. And really what was happening at just this time, the murder that I've written about, is this emergence of detective fiction as a form. And I do think that this emergence of detective fiction just at that period was profoundly connected with the growth of the market and this increase of literacy, and of a public who wanted puzzles to solve. You know, they wanted literary versions of just things that you can sit and mull over and, you know, work out or guess who might have done the crime. And so, of course, it's an immensely appealing form, but I think it's always because of that challenge that it sets the reader. You're given some information and you are invited to sort it all out. Putting those two bodies of energy together is it's a very good formula. Of course, it does draw people in.
That was Claire Harmon. Murder by the Book, a sensational chapter in Victorian crime, is out now in the UK, published by Viking. In the US, it will be published later this month by Deckel Edge, with the different subheading, The Crime That Shocked Dickens's London. And we've now come to the end of today's episode, but we'll be back on Thursday when the topic of conversation will be the Royal Navy.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.